Andrew Hunter, Senior Fellow in the International Security Program and Director of the Defense Industrial Initiatives Group at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Andrew, thanks for your time today. We're learning details now about the National Defense Authorization Act agreed upon by House and Senate conferees and expected to be voted on late this week or early next. What do we know? What are the most important facts that we should know regarding particularly acquisition from the NDAA of this year? Thanks for your time today, Andrew.
Well, thank you, Francis, and thanks for having me on this today. This bill is actually a pretty historic change when it comes to acquisition law. It's a package of provisions that, if you take them all together, is bigger than anything we've probably seen in an acquisition area since 1994. So it's a major change to the system. On the whole, I'd say it's a very positive change. There's a lot of work being done here to try and make the acquisition system more responsive to actually meet warfighter needs, and that's a good thing. There are, of course, some real controversies in there that have caused a lot of dissension, some of which are of concern in my mind as well, but that largely relate to what are the powers of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, their military and civilian senior leaders in making decisions for acquisition in respect to the powers of the Secretary of Defense. And that's been the big dispute that's caused some controversy in this area.
My understanding is that the chiefs of each of the branches would be more involved deeper into the acquisition process if these provisions in the NDAA become law. Is that a fair read on my part? Am I seeing that accurately?
That's true. The service chiefs would be given both more responsibility and more authority in the acquisition realm. They would be required, essentially, to take an active role in some of the acquisition decision-making to make sure that the acquisition strategy and other major acquisition decisions line up with their decisions that they're making on budgets and requirements. And on the whole, I think that's a very positive step. That's kind of the central dilemma of acquisition, is having a well-thought-through, well-coordinated set of requirements, budgets, and acquisition strategy. And so having the service chiefs more directly involved in that is a good step.
Yeah, the terminology that I keep hearing from the former chiefs that I've talked to and the former branch acquisition people that I've talked to is kind of the idea that once an acquisition, the term they use is thrown over the fence, that they're not that involved with it again until it's time for a deliverable.
I think that's the way the system has been operating, and it does need to change. These systems are complex enough, and they take long enough to do, that you need to have a constant and continuous dialogue between the operators, the people who are really going to use it, the folks within the services who are kind of looking at the long term, because acquisition programs are inherently long-term activities, and the folks doing the acquisition. So that dialogue does need to be continuous and updated.
I saw a memo recently that Undersecretary of Defense Kendall sent to the secretaries of the service branches, sending them some authority on particular programs. How is this different than what's in NDAA? Was that an attempt to try to kind of get ahead of the NDAA, or is that a separate issue?
Well, it's something that's been going on for a long time, and actually one of the things that has been a little bit obscured in this debate is that about half of the biggest defense programs are already delegated to the services to make these decisions. So the contrast isn't as stark, perhaps, as the debate would lead one to believe. There is a key difference, however, in that under the current law, these programs get delegated, which means two things. One is that the authority that's being delegated still comes from the Secretary of Defense, and the second thing is that the Secretary of Defense can take it back. under the law, as it would be changed in this bill, were it to be enacted, the authority wouldn't really come from the secretary anymore. It would come from the statute itself, establishing the service acquisition executive as the decision authority for acquisition matters. And the secretary would still have an ability in some cases to take it away. But there is a difference between saying someone has the authority to delegate and then versus saying that it belongs in the hands of the services and it's up to the secretary to make a case to take it away.
Andrew Hunter of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, looking at the National Defense Authorization Act as agreed upon by the House and the Senate. I'll draw on your experience, if I may, as a professional staffer on the House Armed Services Committee. What happens if President Obama, as he has suggested he will, vetoes the NDAA after it appears it will pass the House and Senate? If he vetoes that, do we start all over again? Do we go back to a conference? How does the negotiation process work? Do we just kind of have a standoff until somebody breaks?
Well, there's two ways that this can go, and I will say that during my time working in Congress, there were two defense authorization bills that were vetoed, one by President Clinton and one by President Bush. And in both cases, by the way, the bill ended up becoming law. So this process has happened, and it has generally happened and led to a successful conclusion. The first step that will likely happen, although it is not required, but that will likely happen, is that the houses will consider overriding the veto. Based on the statements that Ranking Member Jack Reed in the Senate and Adam Smith in the House have made, my guess is that the votes are not there to override a veto on this bill. But my guess is that the leadership in the House and Senate might at least want to try and to establish just passing the bill as is. Secondarily, if that does not work, and I don't expect that it will, they tend to go back to the drawing board, but not at square one. Basically, you go back to the bill as it stands and try and determine, you know, what are the minimum changes that can be made that will get it past the president's veto threat. And that's what happened in my direct experience at the tail end of the Bush administration when they vetoed the defense authorization bill because they were concerned about some provisions relating to Iraq. Those provisions were modified, and then the bill was essentially put forward with a very small number of changes, and the second time around, the president agreed to sign it.
The scenario here, though, appears to be pretty clear-cut. President Obama and the administration do not want the 50 however many billion dollars of spending that is now in the overseas contingency operation in the OCO budget. They want it in the base budget. And there are many people on both sides of the aisle who have made arguments about why that's good policy. It just doesn't appear to be able to be happening in this Congress so far. Do we have a sense of whether there's any kind of gray area between the president's position and Congress's position? You have Mac Thornberry on the one hand saying that the White House's position really doesn't make any sense to him.
Yeah, I think effectively what the president's veto does is it links the defense authorization bill to the larger budget debate, which, as you correctly point out, has been at an impasse for some time. And, of course, October 1st, today is October 1st, the government is now operating on a continuing resolution, which has essentially kicked the resolution of this larger budget debate down the road by 2 months. But at some point, of course, a decision will have to be made of whether there's going to be a resolution to the budget caps that will accommodate the president's concerns and the Congress's concerns and find some middle ground, or if we're likely to be on a continuing resolution for the entire year. And I think the strategy that I've heard the White House has adopted here is one that says they don't want the first break from either side to be on the defense authorization bill. It's going to probably be in the budget and appropriations process where that gets solved, and then the defense authorization bill would essentially be resolved according to whichever way that broader budget debate goes.
So we shouldn't worry if this is something that is still hanging around with us as we get close to the December 11th deadline for a new budget vehicle to be in place.
Well, I do think there is cause to worry in that if the broader budget debate it just ends or remains at complete impasse, the defense authorization bill is effectively caught up in that impasse.
Andrew, I appreciate your insights very much. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.